Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very pleased to have as my guest Larissa McFarker. She is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and she has just published her first book. It's a remarkable book. It's called Strangers Drowning. Its subtitle is Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. In the course of reading it, I discovered that I was very interested. You know, usually I'm talking to you about poetry and novels. I regard poets as altruists almost automatically because of the difficulty of living in the world and practicing that art form. Novelists, not as frequently, they have ambitions. But poets are pure. And I read your book, Larissa, and discovered that things had happened to altruism since I last looked. Tell me what altruism is today.
Well, I think what you're referring to is a movement called effective altruism, which has become quite influential among younger people. And it's by no means the only form of altruism around, or even in my book, there are many different kinds of people who have committed themselves to helping others in a very, very extreme way. But effective altruism is all about helping other people in the most pragmatic, data-driven way possible. It's utilitarianism in a new form. It's not interested in things that preoccupied altruists perhaps of decades past, like personal purity, like spontaneous generosity. In fact, though many of the effective altruists are compassionate, generous people, they don't want that to lead their actions. They want their actions to be dictated by evidence and data because that's the way they believe they can most help other people, not by responding to every whimsy of their own heart.
Are you an altruist when you write a book like this?
I would never put myself in the category of the kind of person I'm writing about. I mean, these are people who are so committed to others that they push themselves beyond what most of us can even imagine. These are people who often not only give away 50, 70, 90% of their income, and these are not, you know, Mark Zuckerbergs, these are ordinary people. Not only do they give away so much of their income, some of them actually decide to change their whole lives for the sole purpose of giving away even more money. So whereas an altruist in times past might have gone into the helping professions, a social worker, become an aid worker, a doctor, something like that, nowadays people may go into something like banking or corporate law for the sole purpose of making more money to give away. And that may not be their first choice in profession, but they have decided that it's more important to help others than to do something that they love. I didn't do that. I decided to become a writer, which is what I love. But I've never been completely sure that that was the right thing to do morally. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book.
Because when I think about you and your husband, Philip Gurevich, who covered the Rwandan genocide, we're talking about, well, grappling with impossible idealism, or at least impossible journalism, setting one's life at risk to give an accurate report of a part of the world where things have gone so bad, so off, that help is unimaginable. Accuracy might be the most important thing that can be brought. And so I think of it as altruistic.
It's true. I mean, I believe that journalism is very, very important. It's very important not just for the joy and interest that it can bring, but also for the calamities that it can report on and help to alleviate. But when the journalist, and I myself am one of them, they will spend their days doing their work and then they'll come home and they'll have a respite. They'll have perhaps a family, perhaps at very least some kind of respite, which helps them recover from the day's work. The kind of person I'm writing about doesn't have that. They are committed all the time. So, you know, another example is a couple who live in Philadelphia, Sue and Hector Badeau, who adopted 20 special needs children. They never have a home to go to rest from their work, because their work is all around them all the time. And they love their children, but it's very difficult what they've chosen to do. And there's no rest ever at all.
They did more than adopt 20. They let the friends of their adopted children stay in their house, yes?
Yes.
And they bring refugees yep. from Sudan and Kosovo yep. to live with them. It's an extraordinary
yes.
openness and willingness to the vicissitudes of the world entering the home.
Absolutely. That's what I mean. You know, I do believe that poetry and novel writing and journalism are incredibly important, but the lifestyle of the average writer is just totally different. They rest. Sue and Hector, they never rest. They are always taking care of their children. It was very funny when I met them. Their children had, for the most part, left home. Their youngest kids were in their 20s. But at that point, Hector, every Thursday, I think it was, would have a grandchildren's night where he would babysit for, I can't remember, it was something like 25 children under the age of 7, so his children could go and spend time doing something else. He just never stops. And when their children all left home, he went to work for a homeless shelter.
Well, what fascinated me was when you write about how Susan more and more needed as a lecturer and got a job in Washington, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, yeah.
And then lectured around the country. She was rarely at home. So that these children, these adopted children, of the children, two were biological children, the rest were all adopted. But she was no longer at home. And the idea of a mother in the home, as old-fashioned as it is, turned out to be very important, because the girls didn't want to talk about girl things with their adopted father. Many of these girls had suffered abuse from foster fathers, so they needed the mother at home. So this brings us to that second tier of altruism, where you, in a sense, abandon your own people in order to reach still more outside your home. Now, that kind of altruism, which is now called effective altruism, which is calculated, how many people can you affect? If you were to work as a social worker, you could only earn so much money. But if you gave 80% of your salary, which would leave you with a social worker's salary, working in the stock market or as a banker or as a lawyer, you would be able to create effective altruism on a very large scale while ignoring the people who need you. How does that work?
Well, you know, I do understand that to many people it sounds very cold. It sounds very calculating, and it is calculating. But to me, I think there's something very movingly modest about it because, you know, in the old days, if somebody wanted to become, if someone wanted to help others, they thought, I myself will go and help them. I will become a missionary or an aid worker, et cetera. And I will feel fulfilled and I will see the shining faces. This is, you know, the fantasy, not always the reality, of course. The shining faces and the gratitude of the people I've helped, and that will make me happy and they will be helped by me. These people don't subscribe to that form of sentimentality. They think what's important is that people are helped, not that it is I who is doing the helping. And so I could become an aid worker and travel to some distant country and try to help out, or I could stay in my own country, earn a first world salary, and bankroll 3 or 4 aid workers, local people who will know their own culture better than I ever could and could do more good. And so it would be a kind of vanity in me to imagine that it has to be my tender hands and my tender heart delivering the help, when in fact what many people need is not tender hands, but food.
I'm talking to Larissa McFarker. She's the author of Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. The suggestion here is that empathy is only a part of the equation, that empathy is very important, and you wouldn't be doing these extreme things if you were not feeling empathetic. But in terms of usefulness, there's a whole world of alternative possibility that is also altruism.
You know, it's very interesting that you bring up empathy because I was recently talking with a psychologist at Yale named Paul Bloom, who is working on a book called Against Empathy. And he says people sidle away from him at parties when they hear that title because it just sounds so appalling. It sounds like against puppies or against apple pie. What he means by it is that empathy is not an unadulterated good, that we tend to think it is. But the problem with empathy is that it tends to move us to help people who are like us. People who attract our empathy tend to be people who resemble us in matters of gender, in matters of class and color and nationality in all different ways. And we are not that good at imagining the situations of people very different from us. And so he's not against that. It's sort of a, you know, it's sort of a provocative on purpose title. He's not against all empathy, but he does want us to realize that our heart is not always right, that we need to think if the object of the exercise is to help other people as opposed to feeling warm glows, we need to use our head as well. And I, you know, about Sue, who did go out to work, it's absolutely true. And she did spend a lot of time away from her family. But one of the wonderful things about the Badauds that I love, you know, these do-gooders that I write about are deeply unconventional people. They couldn't live the lives they did if they gave a hoot about what anyone thought. And they decided that what worked for them was different than what worked for other people. And so Hector was the one who stayed home. Certainly one person had to. In their case, it was him. He stayed home. He changed the diapers. He packed the school lunches. He made the dinners. You know, he was there every day. And one of the reasons is that he grew up with this, first of all, he grew up in a family of 16 biological kids. So the chaos of the number of kids didn't seem weird to him. But also, he grew up with a pretty terrible father who was a violent alcoholic. And his dream in life was to become a good father. That's what he wanted to do with his life. And that's what he did.
I want to speak back to the place I came from, which was the 1960s. You know, that's where I came to consciousness. And at that time, unconventional people, as we're calling them, became eccentrics, eccentric intellectuals. They were known for extreme individualism. This is a whole different impulse, whereas that extreme individual might have appeared at a rally, stripped naked, and read a poem at the microphone, asking others to see that what was wrong was conformity, that the problem America was facing was a refusal to get out of line. Tell about the Peter Singer essay, which influenced a man to go and spend his life defending the rights of chickens.
This is a very, very influential essay that's been, it was originally published in the early 70s and has now actually just been republished as a standalone short book. Famine, Affluence, and Morality by the Australian philosopher who's now at Princeton, Peter Singer. And he made the argument, which is now very famous, the shallow pond argument. He says, suppose you're walking along the street and you see a child drowning in a shallow pond. Ought you to rescue him, even if it means possibly ruining your clothes? Everyone says, well, of course you should rescue the child. You would be a monster not to. At which point he says, aha, but there are children drowning in shallow ponds or the, you know, equivalent all over the world all the time. And we are always making the choice to buy clothes, to preserve our clothes, rather than rescue them. How can we justify that? What difference should it make that a child is drowning or dying of an easily preventable reason somewhere else rather than right in front of us? And this is an argument that has persuaded a lot of young people, especially now, to feel that their own self-actualization of the kind that was very deeply valued in the 60s, the kind of thing you're talking about, the feeling that one of the most important things in life is to figure out your authentic self and be true to it, to discover new forms of being, new forms of imaginative freedom, all of those things which are so inspiring and were so inspiring to a generation of people have been rejected by these people because they feel, you know, those things may be wonderful, but how can you talk about realizing your own authentic self when there are people who can't even realize any kind of self because they're about to die of malaria? How can you justify spending money traveling to a dead show rather than spending that money preventing early death?
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Larissa McFarker about her book, Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. We'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcast you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Larissa McFarker about her latest book, Strangers Drowning. Stories of people who've chosen to make deep moral commitments and what that has meant for their daily lives. Do-gooders seem to me to be people who set out apple pies on the windowsill during the Depression.
You know, it's a word that has many negative connotations, and that's part of what I wanted, why I wanted to use it, because I wanted to unpack those ideas that are built into that word and make people think about, well, what is it? Why do we have a problem with people who do good? That's pretty strange. Because just to give you an example, I think there are a couple of contradictory ideas packed into it. One is we have this notion that while evil people are fascinating and complex, good people are boring and dull. And I think this is a very widespread understanding. I was talking to a novelist friend of mine at one point, and I said, it's because it's one of the frustrations of this project that there aren't more novels about people of the kind that I'm obsessed with, these very, very moral people. And I asked the novelist, why don't novelists write about these people? And he gave me this look like I had said, why don't you write a nice novel about butterflies and bunnies? You know, it seemed ludicrous to him. But at the same time, many people think that there's something strange and aggressive and even kind of twisted about do-gooders. Fully 50% of the people I talked to in the course of doing this project said to me, oh, those do-gooders, they're all mentally ill, right? And I said, well, no, but how interesting you should think that. And I became very curious about this ambivalence and even hostility towards these people. And I ended up making that a large part of the book, digging into the history of this ambivalence we have towards moral lives and where it comes from.
Well, don't you think, though, that the culture's obsession with money and power has been part of the reason for the scorn for do-gooders?
I think there's no question that they seem to us strange and irrational. But I think it goes beyond that. There's a sense that it's, you know, if we thought they were simply irrational, they might be just a sort of harmless group of eccentrics that we would allow to go about their business. And if they want to help in soup kitchens rather than buying records, then that's their business. But it's more than that. There's a perception that do-gooders are aggressive towards the rest of us. And on a certain level, this is obvious. You know, if someone is living a very moral life, even if they say nothing to you by way of judgment, you might feel implicitly rebuked by them. But even more than that, there's a sense that there's something aggressive about giving. There's a sense that the person who gives a lot more than most of us is doing something not just eccentric, but positively hostile.
Take me back a couple of steps. You have a chapter about Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. I know once on a time, one of the extraordinary aspects of this organization was not just people with a problem helping others with that problem, but doing it for what's said, for fun and for free. That this was no longer something that would be ruinous in rehab charges. You instead go in a different direction. It's very interesting to me that what came about, especially through Al-Anon, was the concept of codependency, and that helping others led to a sickness perhaps as bad as the original sickness of alcoholism.
My sense with Al-Anon and AA, the moral lesson that came out was not so much that any helping was impossible, but that certain kinds of helping could be a form of disease. AA is founded, as you said, on one alcoholic helping another, and that is unambiguously good. The kind of helping that Al-Anon, which is the organization founded by the spouses and families and friends of alcoholics, their analysis was that what used to be a virtue in emblematically the wife of the alcoholic trying her best to prevent him from drinking, trying to control him, trying to make him behave better, stealing his bottles away, doing everything she could to get him better, was not only not helpful, but was an entangled form of the same disease, that there was a kind of disease construct in which the two, the alcoholic and the would-be helper, were stuck together, and that what needed to happen was that the would-be helper, typically a spouse or a partner, had to remove him or herself and to just accept the alcoholic needing to fix himself rather than him or her helping. And that, I think, was a very novel idea that had enormous implications because, as you say, it spawned the concept of codependency, which spread to much more widely throughout the culture, far beyond the smaller area of addiction, the idea that many kinds of helping were not, in fact, good for either the helper or the helpee. They were a kind of obsession with control, a need to dominate, a need to force others to conform to your own norms of behavior. It cast what used to be virtues into a very unflattering light. And I don't think anyone ever thought that applied to all forms of helping, but I think it contributed to the sense we now have that is embedded in the term do-gooder, that there's something suspect about someone who tries to help another person, that they're not just trying to help in a removed way. They're also trying to control and to dominate.
One of the things that I loved about Larissa McFarker's book, Strangers Drowning, is that it's full, like a novel, of fascinating characters. Like a postmodern novel, they don't necessarily connect with one another. They're drawn together by abstractions. I learned all kinds of things while reading. And so I feel as if, Larissa, you've extended a hand and taken me over a boundary into the world surrounding me of which I'd remained ignorant because I'd been reading so many novels, so many works of fiction.
Yep.
So I thought we'd close with, you have a very impressive claim for nonfiction writing, which this semester you're teaching at Stanford, and that you work with fiction writers and remind them that there are other options beside fiction, that nonfiction is full of extraordinary, unexamined choices.
It's true. I mean, the thing that I love about nonfiction is that you're always surprised, that people, I mean, it's a cliche to say that truth is stranger than fiction, but it's one that I found to be deeply true, and that is incredibly exciting to me. I realized why I was so committed to nonfiction when I was having lunch with a friend of mine recently who was a novelist, but he was working on his first nonfiction book, and he'd gone on a reporting trip for it, and he came back and he was very frustrated. He said, "You know, I had this book in my mind. I knew the characters. I could hear them. I could feel them. I could see them. I knew what they were going to say. I knew how their stories would go," because he's a novelist. He can create something out of nothing, which I can't do. And he'd come back from this trip and he said, "You know, it was so annoying. They didn't say what I wanted them to say. And they weren't as that I had pictured them. And they said something totally different." And it was very frustrating to me. And I thought, I've never had that thought. It's always totally delightful to me when people say something that I never in a million years expected or could create out of my own head. And that's why I love meeting the people I've met.
I've been speaking with Larissa McFarker, author of Strangers Drowning. The subtitle is Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. It's published by the Penguin Press. Thank you for joining me, Larissa. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Strangers Drowning at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from Bookworm or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is acting as co-producer today. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm, a sadder but wiser bookworm. Thank you.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Ryan Gaddis is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.